Hello, good morning and welcome to Money Talk from Channel Radio. It's noon, it's Friday, and the next hour you're in the company of Simon Webster, the Money Talk guru. In my day job, I'm the Managing Director of Facts and Figures with Charter Financial Planners based in Ashford. And our task here is to share a little bit of the information that we have on matters financial to help you make informed decisions about your future, so that you can put it in perspective, work out what it's going to cost. Only you, though, can gauge the value. Today's headline is money and tax. And I can't think of a more complicated, challenging or less exciting subject to have to spend an hour talking about. But the truth of the matter is, they always used to say, there are but two certainties in life, death and taxes. I think a few years ago they made it three and said that the three certainties in life are death, taxes and change. Which, whichever way you dress it up, tax is in there and always will be, at least I think for my lifetime and yours. So today we're going to talk about tax, what it is, what you have to pay, what you can do to not pay it, and we're going to talk about whether you should try and avoid not paying your tax or should avoid trying to pay your tax. We'll get there in the end. In a modern civil society, the payment of tax serves several purposes. I would argue the most important is probably the provision of education. With education, people have the power to advance and take control of their lives. Without it, we'd still all be in caves. In the UK, tax provides universal healthcare in the form of the good old NHS. Let's face it, it was the biggest thing that we had to offer at the Olympics. And much song and dance was made about it. It's the largest employer in the UK. And I think we all sleep a little easier in our beds at night in the knowledge that if we become ill or if we're injured, an ambulance just shows up and takes us to hospital and makes us better if it's possible to do it. And we don't have to get saddled with a bill and they don't spend 2 hours trying to fill in your insurance forms as they do in the States. So tax paying for healthcare is obviously a huge advantage. On the more political level, tax can be used to redistribute wealth from those that earn money to those that don't, or to those that earn less. And I think that performs a very valuable societal purpose. The question, of course, is always going to be how much wealth should be distributed. Those that receive benefits would argue much more. Those that pay the tax would argue no more, and some would perhaps argue less. Another purpose of taxation is that it pays for infrastructure. Our road network is funded by taxation, apart from the M6, the Dartford Toll Tunnel, and one or two other places where you do pay tolls in this country. But primarily, our infrastructure projects are funded by tax. Then the emergency services, the other emergency services. We've talked about health, but anything with a blue light on it is probably funded by taxation. So we're thinking here of the police and the fire brigade, both of whom perform vital civil functions, and without them, I think we'd all be very worried. We also pay for defence. You can argue about whether defence is a good thing or a bad thing, but the truth of the matter is we all probably sleep a bit sounder in our beds in the knowledge that we have an army, we have defences, we have a navy, we have an air force, and we have the means of protecting ourselves as a nation should anybody get aggressive. Of course, the problem now is that we're fighting terrorism. It's a slightly different sort of defence is required, and we could spend several days debating how best to go about that. So we're just looking about how we pay for it. Now, tax doubtless funds a whole pile of other stuff. When you actually look, I looked at a chart this morning when I was preparing this show, and I'd nearly forgotten I got it up here. If you look at it, the tax take in the UK is about £550 billion. A billion here, a billion there. You're soon talking about big money. £122 billion of that £550 billion is spent on health. It is the second largest spend that the government makes. £180 billion is on helping others. So that's the welfare, benefits, working tax credits, pensions, tax credits and others. There's £29 billion spent on running the country in what they call social systems. Interestingly, only 32 billion is spent on education, and the health budget is, what, four times the education budget. Could have a very interesting debate as to whether if you doubled the education budget, we'd suddenly become a much more successful and profitable country, and we'd all be doing a lot better. But that's perhaps a debate for another day. We only spend around 16 billion on order and safety, so that's mainly the police and things related to them. Our defence budget is double that at about 35, 36 billion. Apparently we have a £7 billion culture spend. I think a lot of people worry about the fact that we spend a lot of money on culture and supporting art and or the arts more widely. But the truth of the matter is I think you measure the quality of a society by how it supports its culture. And, of course, UK culture provides a huge boost to the tourist industry, so there's probably a quid pro quo there. The one number that I found really quite surprising is that the cost of running government, the cost of actually administering this £550 billion spend, is £67 billion. Now, that struck me as absolutely ridiculously large. And when you start looking at this and thinking about tax, if there was money to save, I would say we ought to cut the cost of our government. And, of course, every time we open a devolved parliament, what does that do? Does that increase government costs or decrease them? I'll let you do the maths. I think we might be talking about Scottish devolution briefly later on. You might already have an inkling of my feeling on that subject. It's got nothing to do with nationalism or independence, just value for money for the poor old taxpayer. We've said that tax as a percentage, tax is about £550 billion. Excuse me. That's the tax take in the UK. And that amounts to about 36% of UK gross domestic product. Now, gross domestic product is a term often bandied about. I'm not sure people really understand what it means, but really it's how much money is spent in the UK economy. And we're saying that 36% of the money spent in the UK economy is going straight to government. Now, that is a huge, huge percentage. And, of course, when you think about it, if that 36% of money spent in the economy is going through the government and a significant proportion of our citizens do not pay any tax, what do you think the actual tax burden is on those people who pay the tax? That's an interesting question. And a lot has been talked about tax and morality recently. It was only yesterday I heard Gary Barlow, 3 months after the event, apologise on Twitter for his tax planning errors. That's a very, very interesting moral debate that you could spend a couple of hours on its own. But we need to think about this, because taxation is a matter of law. The government has all the power. It controls the courts indirectly. And they can set the rules that say if you have any money at all, you've got to pay tax on it. If you own a house, you've got to pay tax on it. And they do. It's called rates or community council tax now. If you sell a house, you've got to pay tax. Or you, in fact, if you buy a house, you've got to pay tax rather than sell it. If you sell a second house, you've got to pay tax. If you earn money, you've got to pay tax. And they stipulate how much and on what money you pay it. And in point of fact, the Inland Revenue, it's always amused me, has never defined income for tax purposes. And the reason they've never defined income for tax purposes is, of course, as soon as they do, some smart accountant or lawyer is going to devise a form of remuneration that is not income under the Inland Revenue's definition, and it will automatically fall outside tax. So they've left that wide open. So I think it's very important to think about tax in a moral context, but then to ask the question, well, the government has all the power, the government has all the legislators. Goodness only knows, we've just said they spend £76 billion running the country. If they want to decide that people should pay more tax or pay tax in a different way or pay tax on certain things that they're not paying tax at the moment, all they have to do is pass a law. Rather than standing up on soapboxes saying so-and-so is morally bankrupt because they're not paying their fair share. The fair share is what the law says it is, no more, no less. Now, I happen to be a Christian, and so I'm always careful about quoting the words of Jesus, but it's a very interesting standpoint. Right back in Bible times, the Pharisees were seeking to trick Jesus into setting himself up as some sort of rebel leader. And they said, "Teacher, you know you are a man of integrity and that you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. You aren't swayed by others because you pay no attention to who they are. Tell us then, what is your opinion? Is it right to pay the imperial tax to Caesar or not?" Jesus, knowing their evil intent, said, "You hypocrites, why are you trying to trap me? Show me the coin used for paying the tax." And they brought him a denarius, and he asked them, "Whose image is this, and whose inscription?" And they said, "Caesar's," the emperor at the time. So he said to them, "So give back to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's." So should we, in that context, give Caesar his due? These days, Caesar is the state. And so while Jesus' teaching is a useful moral background, a very famous judge once limited that responsibility. And before I show the quote, I need to give you some idea of the man who said it. I'm working on the assumption most of you knew who Jesus was. But a guy called James Avon Clyde, who became Lord Clyde, lived between 1863 and 1944, was a Scottish politician and judge. Clyde was called to the Scottish Bar in 1889, appointed a King's Counsel, a senior barrister, in August 1901. He was later Dean of the Faculty of Advocates between 1815 and 1818. He briefly held office as a Solicitor General for Scotland in late 1905, and he sat as a Liberal Unionist Member of Parliament for Edinburgh West between 1909 and 1918. He was appointed a Privy Councillor in 1960, and he served as Lord Advocate between 1916 and 1920. He was Lord Justice General and Lord President of the Court of Session between 1920 and 1935 with the judicial title Lord Clyde. So just that gives you a CV. This guy was a big cheese in the law. And he said some very famous words, which are well known in taxation circles, in a case of Ayrshire Pullman Motor Services versus the Inland Revenue in 1929. And these words resound nearly 100 years later. "No man in the country is under the smallest obligation, moral or other, so to arrange his legal relations to his business or property as to enable the Inland Revenue to put the largest possible shovel in his stores. The Inland Revenue is not slow, and quite rightly, to take every advantage which is open to it under the taxing statutes for the purposes of depleting the taxpayer's pocket. And the taxpayer is in like manner entitled to be astute to prevent, so far as he honestly can, the depletion of his means by the Inland Revenue. In other words, render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, but no more." So broadly speaking, Lord Clyde said, tax is a matter of law. Give the state its due, but no more, and you are not obliged to so order your affairs that you give the state the most tax possible. In fact, you should so order your affairs that the taxman only gets what he is legally entitled to. And here's the thing. As I said before, the elected politicians have the power to change the law and make tax rates higher and to widen the scope of taxations if they choose to. So I've really been alarmed by the way that some politicians have sought to make the payment of tax some sort of moral duty. That is simply lazy government. They have £79 billion to do it with. Write a law that gets in the tax that you want and the people can vote on it. You want rich people to pay more tax, then change the law, and then there is clarity. There will, of course, be those who say it's not fair that some people have lots of money and others have nothing, and I agree. The obvious answer is to raise taxes on the rich, but Labour tried that in the 70s, and the resultant brain drain of our brightest and best high earners was spectacular, as high earners simply flooded offshore in droves. And in case we are in any doubt, companies, who many say have too much money and too much power, can do exactly the same. International law allows multinational companies to organise their affairs so that they can trade in one region and pay tax in another. When you think about it, in broad terms, there are people who pay tax and those who receive benefits. Those that receive the benefits are understandably always going to want more, while those that pay the tax will, by and large, prefer to choose how they distribute their own money themselves. All the various nation states have to do is get together and agree a better global tax strategy. But all the time, some countries can get an advantage for their citizens by lowering tax rates if profits are declared in their own country, and here the Republic of Ireland is a prime example, it won't happen. If the UK acts in isolation, all the big companies will simply make sure that as much of their revenue as possible is reported elsewhere, and we in the UK will end up with less. I've heard people say that wouldn't happen. But in Kent, you only have to look at Pfizer's decision on their Kent plant. Now, as it happens, as far as I'm aware, Pfizer's decision had to do with what they thought they were going to get out of research and development from the Pfizer site in Sandwich. And they just pulled the plug, and a multi-million pound investment was closed down effectively overnight, losing several thousand jobs because Pfizer thought they could get better bang for their buck elsewhere. The fact of the matter is, directors of companies are responsible to their shareholders to, dare I say it, make profit. And tax is effectively just another business expense. And if the company pays tax, the money is not available to be distributed to shareholders. To me, it's actually going to be very interesting to see what happens in the Scottish referendum. The Nationalists are promising to spend a lot more money, based largely on North Sea oil receipts. These receipts are both finite, as oil will run out, and uncertain due to fluctuations in world oil prices. I mean, we've seen it double and halve in the last 5 years. The only other source of tax revenue for the Scots are the businesses and taxpayers that reside there. So if the Scottish Government starts pushing taxes up, how many of these taxpayers and companies will simply hop over the border to the UK and take all their tax revenues with them? It's an interesting debate. I don't have a vote, but if I lived in Scotland, I'd be voting no. Now, there are three or four taxes that we can talk about. We're going to talk about capital gains tax first, but I think you need a break, and so do I. So let's have some music.
Casting from Haglands Village on Romney Marsh, 24 hours a day. Channel Radio.
When I find myself in times of trouble, Mother Mary comes to me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be. And in my hour of darkness, she is standing right in front of me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be. Let it be, let it be, let it be. Whisper words of wisdom, let it be. And when the broken-hearted people living in the world agree, there will be an answer, let it be. For though they may be parted, there is still a chance that they will see. There will be an answer, let it be. Let it be. is cloudy, there is still a light that shines on me. Shine until tomorrow, let it be. I wake up to the sound of music. Mother Mary comes to me, speaking words of wisdom. Let it be. Yeah, let it be. Let it be. Let it be. Yeah, let it be. For there will be an answer. Let it be.
There's Paul McCartney at his best. It was in looking for the Beatles track Taxman that I found that this morning, but sadly our copy here is not up for broadcast quality, but I thought Let It Be was a nice one from the Beatles to have as a little interlude. I promised you a little section on capital gains tax. I suspect you were probably expecting me to start on income tax, but actually capital gains tax is probably one of the most interesting taxes, and it's worth spending a few minutes on here. For those that aren't familiar with the UK tax system, capital gains tax is effectively a tax on the increase in value of an asset while it is in your possession. Let us take, let's take a house, one that you don't live in. You buy a house for £100,000, you sell it 10 years later for £200,000, you have made a gain of £100,000, and that gain is taxable. The first £11,000 of the gain is offset against your capital gains tax allowance, so you actually only have to pay tax on £89,000. Now, you'd pay tax at basic rate at 18%, and tax capital gains tax at higher rate at 28%. So capital gains tax rates are lower than income tax rates, which are 20 and 40% respectively. But it doesn't alter the fact that it is a fairly significant wad of money to have to find if you dispose of an investment property. Now, there are a few things that you can do to mitigate the effects of capital gains tax. The first thing is you can make use of the interspousal exemption. It's a marvellous phrase, but effectively, if you give half your property to your partner, married partner, or I've forgotten the perishing term, it'll come back to me later. If you give half your property to your spouse, then that property is not that transfer is not a chargeable event. So if you have a £100,000 gain and you give half the property to the wife, that's £50,000 gain each. And the reason you might want to do that is that you would then have an £11,000 allowance each. So effectively, you've just taken an extra £11,000 out of tax. Now, common law partners are not recognised, and civil partners, the phrase I couldn't think of earlier, are. But it does effectively mean that if you are two cohabitees and you own a second property together, then you ought to put it in joint names from day one, because if it is a sole name, you can't then transfer it unless without triggering a chargeable event and triggering some tax. So a transfer between spouses is exempt. A transfer between common law partners is a chargeable event. And it's quite an important little wrinkle to be aware of. Now, the big thing that is worth bearing in mind is that this personal allowance does not get carried forward. It's one of those allowances that accrues in a particular tax year, and it's use it or lose it. So if you hold an investment, say that property, for 10 years, and you make a gain of £10,000 each year, then you've got your £100,000 gain. If it had sold the property and bought it back again, and sold the property and bought it back again, each tax year, and there's a reason you might not be able to do that. Well, there's several reasons why you might not be able to do it, but you'd still made 10 lots of £10,000 gain. Each gain would have been within the personal allowance, and therefore you would have saved a lot of tax. Now, there's two things with rolling over property on an annual basis. One is you've got huge dealing costs. And the second one is to stop something that used to be called bed and breakfasting of investments. You can't sell an investment and then buy it back the next day. You've got to be away from that investment for 30 days before you can do it. And, of course, the big issue with doing that with a property is the dealing costs, stamp duty, solicitor's fees, and the general hassle. And you just start thinking, to save a few bob in tax, it just isn't worth it. But with investments, it becomes a slightly different proposition. Stocks and shares and unit trusts are paper-based investments and can be easily bought and sold. And this, dear listener, is something I want to flag up for you because you really need to hear this and be aware of it. If you have money invested with any unit trust company, or investment trust company, then you are storing up capital gains every single year. And one of the things the banks are very good at is putting you into some sort of managed fund that you stay in for a number of years, and then you work out, probably a little late to the party if it's a, if you're a typical facts and figures client, that the bank has actually not been doing a terribly good job of investing your money, and you say, well, would you please, facts and figures, look after my money for me? And we say, yes, we'd love to, but if we sell all your investments now and put them into something that's doing a little bit better, you will have to pay a lot of capital gains tax because the bank has not managed your capital gains tax position for you. And selling all your investments in one year means one big capital gain and you end up with a big capital gains tax charge. Now, the way to do it is to sell your investments in a succession of tax years. So instead of selling the whole thing at one stage, you wait until the next 6th of April and you sell another load of investment and then another load of investment and another load of investment years apart. But of course, it is very clunky and inefficient, and it's a real pain if you've decided that you want to move away. Now, what we do in our particular business, and I ask a lot of other financial advisors what they do, and a lot of them don't seem to do anything with it at all, is we try to manage our clients' capital gains tax position as part of our portfolio management service. Now, just to give you an idea of what this might be worth to the average investor, if you were fortunate enough to have £250,000 and it was invested returning just about 5%, then over a five-year term, you would roll up £340,000. If your full CGT allowance had been used, you would roll up £355,000. That would be a £15,000 difference. If you'd invested that money over 10 years at 5%, you would have gone from £250,000 to £464,000 without using your CGT allowance, so that's what you would have after tax. If your CGT allowance had been used, you'd have £506,000. You would have made a difference of £42,000. And over a 20-year term, and lots of people leave their money invested for this sort of time frame, you'd have £495,000 after tax, or £1,031,843,000, a difference of £136,000. So for that reason, it really is very important that you manage your CGT. And if you've got a financial advisor or a bank looking after your money at the moment, then you really, really, really need to ask them very seriously what they are actually doing about your capital gains tax. And you need to be looking at this actively because it can make a huge, huge difference to your returns. And nobody wants to pay tax they don't need to. And all you need to do is sell your investments during the course of a tax year, trigger an £11,000 gain. And if you've got a partner, then a married partner or a civil partner, pass some of the investments to her or him and trigger some of their allowance as well. Use up that £11,000 or £22,000 in the tax year and then wait 30 days, which is this new wrinkle on the bed and breakfast scenario, and you will have saved a significant amount of tax on your investments.
Temp Network have hundreds of vacancies across West Kent. We offer ongoing work, weekly pay, and a variety of shift patterns to suit your needs. Visit us at www.tempnetwork.co.uk or call Tunbridge Wells 531-777.
Let's work it to the bone, bone, bone. Come on, work.
Now, the next thing we want to look at is income tax. And just about everybody in the country who works pays tax. And this is the one that most of us think about most of all. Those who are working and who are not self-employed are usually on a salary, and therefore they're paid on what's called a PAYE basis, or pay as you earn. Each month you get a personal allowance or a proportion of your personal allowance, and you pay tax on the difference. How much personal allowance you get is determined by your tax code, but in theory, most people who are not in receipt of other benefits will get a tax code of 1000L, which means you get the full personal income tax allowance for 2014-15 of £10,000. Each month you can earn £833.33, that's a 12th of the £10,000, and then you pay tax on the first £32,000 over that 10 grand at 20%. So in other words, you have to be earning £42,010 before you pay higher rate tax at 40%. And on income between taxable income of £32,011 and £150,000, you pay 40% tax. And income over £150,000, you pay tax at 45%. So I'll just go through that again. £10,000 personal allowance, basic rate tax on the next £32,000, higher rate tax at 40% on the band £32,000 to £150,000, and 45% tax on income over £150,000. We should be so lucky, eh, listeners? But there are a few wrinkles. For taxpayers with income between £50,000 and £60,000, who would normally be in receipt of child benefit, your child benefit gets taken away on your totally if you earn over £60,000. For taxpayers whose income is between £50,000 and £60,000, the amount of charge will be 1% of the amount of child benefit for every £100 of income that exceeds £50,000. For example, the child benefit for two children is £1,752. For a taxpayer whose income is £54,000, the charge would be £700.80, i.e. £17.52 for every £100 earned above £50,000. For a taxpayer whose income is £62,000, the charge will be £1,752, which of course wipes the whole thing out. So that really means that the effective income tax rate on people earning between £50,000 and £60,000 is rather higher than 40%. It could be as high as 50. So it's worth bearing in mind that if you're fortunate enough to be on a salary of between £50,000 and £60,000, because of the law, and you have children and are therefore entitled to child benefit, which is normally collected by the wife in these circumstances, the mother, then it might be worth thinking about strategies to reduce your income. I'll come back to that. Another little wrinkle in our illustrious tax system, it's never been totally straightforward and easy and clear to work out, is if your income is over £100,000, your personal allowance, that £10,000 we mentioned that was tax-free earlier, your personal allowance goes down by £1 for every £2 that your income is above £100,000, which means that if your income is over £120,000 or above, then your personal allowance is zero. And again, that bumps up your effective tax rate significantly. And I wonder if there might be a way of reducing your income from £120,000 to £100,000. There will be huge tax savings in that circumstance. The other point to bear in mind is that there's also national insurance. Now, most people think of national insurance as just that, insurance. But effectively, the truth of the matter is, it's just tax. There's no other way of describing it. It is merely another form of tax, and it's paid by employees, by the self-employed, by employees, and by companies. And it's an important thing to bear in mind that the national insurance rate, actually, I think it's 12.8% for employees on banded earnings and 13.8% for employers. It's a lot of money. So if you're paying somebody £20,000, the employer is paying the thick end of £2,000 or so in national insurance. Now, they've actually just introduced a little £2,000 allowance, which is quite handy for employers, but that will doubtless be temporary, and it's really only there to stimulate the economic recovery. But national insurance is still a significant chunk of your income, and you have to pay it whether you're employed or self-employed, and the companies have to pay it as well. So it's worth thinking about what your national insurance bill is, because it's going out of your wages every month. Self-employed people pay income tax on their net profits, i.e. business receipts less business expenses. So, for example, if you are a gardener and you earn £20,000 or you turn over £20,000, you might have £5,000 expenses for weed killer, gardening gloves, travel to and from work, various qualifications, your insurance, and anything else that you might need. So you earn 20, you have £5,000 worth of expenses, and you've therefore made a net profit, and that net profit is the amount that you pay tax on. It's worth understanding this, because the number of self-employed people I have spoken to over the years who said, well, we turned over £20,000 last year, so that's the income I want the building society to use when they consider how much I can borrow for my mortgage. But it ain't the case. They will look at the £15,000. And a lot of people, when they're starting up, they have relatively low receipts and relatively high expenses. And they say, well, my turnover is very good, but I've made no net profit. But the turnover, they'll lend me on my turnover. No, they won't. They will lend you money based on your net profit. And if your net profit is relatively low, then any mortgage expectation you're going to have is fairly modest. Just a quick word for the self-employed. If you are setting yourself up, you must register with HMRC as a self-employed person at the earliest opportunity. If you don't, you can expect to get a slap from the taxman, and that's not something that you want. You will also be racking up your weekly national insurance charge, which you have to pay every single week, whether you're making a profit or not. So it's worth bearing in mind that you must register a self-employed at the earliest opportunity. Talking of self-employed people, the other sort of category increasingly in a country full of small business are company directors, people who own their own businesses. In fact, I fall under that particular category. And it's worth bearing in mind that it is still probably worthwhile company directors taking their money out of their companies as dividends rather than income in the form of salary. Now, let's just give you a little example. I Googled dividend versus salary calculator. There's loads and loads and loads of them about. If you took £50,000 out of the business as pure salary, pure director's salary, then you would pay 33.63% in tax. Now, that's tax, national insurance, and the corporation tax implications of that money. If, on the other hand, you took the £50,000 out of your business as dividend and just take £10,000 out of the company as salary, which of course is a nil charge to tax, then you would pay 18.49% of your £50,000 as tax, less than half your tax bill. Now, well, not less than half, but almost half your tax bill. Now, it is hugely interesting to me, and there'll be people that say you shouldn't do it, but the reality of the situation is, if you've got the choice between having to pay a lot of tax or having to pay a bit less tax, I would tend to recommend paying the bit less tax. If you wish to be altruistic and make a financial contribution to society, write a cheque to a registered charity where the administration costs are not £79 billion. But give yourself the choice. I think flexibility and choice, personal accountability, are very important. But you should have the choice. Don't hide behind the government. So what else can you think about? Well, we've talked about being employed. We've talked about being a company director. We've talked about being self-employed. But what else can you do in terms of trying to save tax? Well, if you have savings income and a lower or non-taxpaying partner, you could assign that income to the lower taxpaying partner. If you've got a building society account, you've just got to fill in a form with the building society. If you've got investments, you can do pretty much the same sort of thing with them. And that's a very useful, very easy, very cheap way of just moving money around and minimising your tax bill. Another big tax relief is the rent-a-room scheme. You can get £4,250 a year income from renting a room in your house totally tax-free. You don't have to fill in a tax return. You don't have to declare it. And it's just there, and it's tax-free, and you're away. Another tax wrinkle, whether you are a taxpayer or not, you can pay up to £3,600 into a pension, and you will get 20% tax relief on that pension contribution. So, grandparents, you could pay £3,600 into a pension on behalf of a child. Husbands or common law partners, either of either sex, you could pay £3,600 into a pension for your non-working spouse or partner. They will get basic rate tax relief on that money. The net cost to you will then be a little over £2,800. You've made nearly £600 in tax that you haven't even paid. It's one of those nice little wrinkles left over from the stakeholder regime. But it does mean that one of the kindest things grandparents can do for their grandchildren is stick money into a pension. The kids can't get it till they're 55, so they're not going to fritter it away. But it does at least mean they're going to have a halfway decent start to their retirement income, because that money is going to be put away for an extra 10, 15, 18 years. You're making it for them while they are still children. But then that brings us to the other obvious strategy for minimising your tax, which is pension planning, a subject that we often come back to in this programme, but is nonetheless a huge advantage and merits being talked about on a regular basis. For example, if you're earning £55,000 a year in salary and losing half your child benefit, if you make a pension contribution of £5,000, you will receive 40% income tax on that contribution. You will also have £5,000, be deemed to have £5,000 less taxable income, and therefore you will not lose your child benefit. If you have a salary of £120,000 and you make a £20,000 pension contribution, you will lose a large chunk, well, in fact, you will get back all of your personal allowance, and you'll get tax relief at 40% on your pension contribution. Effectively, that is over 50% tax relief in both cases. It is a huge, huge, huge advantage. And if you are fairly close to retirement age, you can get that money out when you've retired, 25% of it tax-free, and if you organise it correctly, the rest of it at 20% tax. I mean, it's just moving your money around for the best possible advantage. Of course, you can't get it out without buying an annuity until past the advent of the new budget legislation in March next year. But you get the idea. There are huge planning opportunities there, and it's absolutely worth thinking about. The other tax whizzes are the ones that the government has specifically set up and allows, nay, encourages all of us to use. And I'm thinking here of the new ISA, or NISA, as it's referred to. And I think it's quite a clever term, really, the NISA ISA, because you can now put £15,000 into an ISA. You don't get tax relief on the way in, but all your capital gains and your income is tax free. A word on cash ISAs. Let's pretend you're getting a 3% interest rate on £10,000. That means you've earned £300 in interest on a year. If you're a base rate taxpayer, that means you would have paid 60 quid tax and you've saved 60 quid. Now, I suppose 60 quid is useful, but if you're losing on your interest rate because you've not got a terribly attractive cash ISA interest rate and you can't move your money around, it's almost not worth having. And I actively encourage those clients whose risk attitude does not preclude them from looking at stock market investment to use their ISA allowance for stocks and shares ISAs. I don't rate cash ISAs at all, unless you're just going to use them as a tax-efficient savings scheme for emergency money, in which case you might just as well have the tax as not. But that's about the only time I'd seriously think about cash ISAs, unless you are somebody who is totally and utterly risk-averse or likely to need the money in the next year or two. Now, there are three other little tax avoidance wrinkles. And it's probably worth just talking about the difference between tax avoidance and evasion. Tax avoidance is a legal way of not paying tax. Tax evasion is an illegal way of trying to evade paying tax. And if you do that too much, you go to jail. So tax avoidance, legal. Tax evasion, illegal. So legal tax avoidance. We've talked about NISAs. We've talked about pensions. What about enterprise investment schemes and venture capital trusts? Now, those are two schemes launched by the government to encourage you and I to put money into fledgling businesses in the hope that they're going to stimulate the economy. They are not for the risk averse. They are not for the investment faint-hearted. And I certainly wouldn't bet your house on one. But if you pay a lot of tax, it might be worth considering. Another investment that has gained a lot of traction, particularly amongst the lovey set, the Jimmy Carrs and the Gary Barlows of this world, are film partnerships. These were introduced by a left-wing chancellor, namely Gordon Brown, to support the British film industry. Of course, what happened was the legislation was sufficiently woolly in its drafting that it left the clever tax planners opportunities to manipulate film partnerships in such a way as to create artificial losses for tax purposes, which in theory, in the letter of the law, actually work for tax purposes. But there are some ongoing challenges in the courts where the revenue is taking some of these schemes to court. Now, if the revenue wins, then the people will get their will have to pay the tax on the money that they invested. If the revenue loses, then the Chancellor should have got his legislation right. He had a £79 billion budget to play with to weight the deck in his favour. Do I sound ever so slightly cynical this morning? I just think that the government, if they want their tax, all they've got to do is draft the laws correctly. If they're going to start making moral pronouncements on things, then get your own house in order first, mate. I think it's time for a break. It's inevitable.
Like
Okay, so we've done income tax, we've done capital gains tax, and the last one to have a look at is probably going to be inheritance tax. Inheritance tax is one of those interesting things that everybody tends to think, it's not going to make a huge difference, we're going to be okay. In fact, Roy Jenkins once described inheritance tax as a voluntary levy paid by those who distrust their heirs more than they dislike the Inland Revenue. Sadly, it's not so much like that now. They've really tightened up and there is not a huge amount of scope to avoid inheritance tax. But the key thing is the first £325,000 of somebody's estate when they die is exempt. So if there's a couple, because you get an allowance each, that means you've got to be worth £650,000 dead before you pay any inheritance tax at all. Now, for a lot of people outside of the southeast of England, £650,000 is almost undreamed of wealth. But if you want to buy a house in the UK, in the southeast, you're going to need a fairly large amount of money. And the way prices keep going up, you're going to end up with a fairly valuable asset by the time you die. And it has been historically that inheritance tax relief rates have not kept pace with inflation. So we've seen a situation now where the 650 threshold that came in only a couple of years ago was a little bit of a jump. But for the several years prior to that, it had barely gone up at all. So we've now got a situation where if you're lucky enough to own a house in the UK, if you're lucky enough to own a house in the southeast and you have some other assets, you could very easily find yourself leaving your dependents with a fairly significant bill. But perhaps we've got a little bit ahead of ourselves because I haven't made the obvious statement for those who aren't aware. Inheritance tax is effectively a tax on the value of all your stuff, whatever country in the world it is situated in, at the time of your death. If you're in a civil partnership or a married couple, it would be at the time of the second death on the assumption that you left all your stuff to your partner. So, again, it comes back to this fact that the £325,000 transferable nil weight band, as they call it, gives you the £650 between two people. But once you get over £650,000, inheritance tax bites at 40%. So on an estate of £1,050,000, you're going to have to pay tax of £160,000. That's 40% of the £400,000 in excess of the £650 nil rate band. See, I cheated slightly just to add the extra few tens of thousands on the back there, just trying to get my maths right. Seem to be having better luck with my maths than some of my words today. But you get the idea. So it's a very significant amount of tax, and it has to be paid before any of a deceased person's estate or stuff, in the modern parlance, is actually transferred. So if you've got a valuable property and some other assets, you have to pay the tax man before you can pay the kids or the other beneficiaries. And it is quite a big issue. So you need to be thinking very carefully about how you deal with inheritance tax. Now, the big problem for most people is that most of their value, or most of the value of their estates, is tied up in their main residence, the house that they live in, and you cannot do very much tax planning around a personal residence that you live in. If you give the house away to your kids and continue to live in it, it is deemed to be a gift with reservation, and therefore inheritance tax just assumes that it's still your house. So the only way you can get away with it is if you lived in your house and paid your kids rent for the privilege of living in your own house, which might be taken by some to be ever so slightly over the top. If you've got cash, then there are some things you can do. You can actually give money into a trust, and if you keep it under the £325,000, that will not trigger a tax bill. And then the growth of the value of the money in the trust is outside your estate immediately, and the money is deemed to be outside of your estate 7 years from the time that you have made the gift. So that's one worthwhile strategy that's worth thinking about. If you're a little older, you might think about a discounted gifts trust where they actually enhance the value of the gift for inheritance tax purposes, and effectively it's a little bit more tax efficient. We can't really get into it in too much detail at this point. But those are two worthwhile strategies. The other one that we're thinking about, most people know that if they give stuff away and survive 7 years and it's under the 325, they won't have any inheritance tax to pay. But the other major opportunity in inheritance tax planning is use of business property relief. Now, business property relief says if you own a business asset for 2 years or more, it's outside the estate for inheritance tax purposes. Now, what that means is you could actually put your money into EIS, which is deemed to be a business property relief qualifying asset, hold the money in there for 2 years, and it's outside your estate. Now, the problem with EIS type investments is that they are fairly high risk, so they're not for the faint-hearted. But there are a few companies that have set up special EIS qualifying arrangements that try to be as low risk as these type of things possibly can be. It's also worth saying that you can't put ISAs or NISAs in trust and outside of your estate for tax purposes, so you lose you'll lose their 40% of their value if you're over the 650 nil rate band. But you could put the money into an EIS qualifying ISA. Again, the risk questions apply, and you've got to think very carefully about it, and you shouldn't be playing with any of this stuff without taking full independent financial advice before you go. But it's certainly worth thinking about. As I sort of parting shot today, I wanted just to give you 30 quick ways of saving tax. I don't think we'll get through all of them, but the first one, on income tax at least, is check your tax code. You'd be surprised how many people do not have the right one. Point two, already made, make use of your capital gains tax allowance every year if you possibly can. Use it or lose it. Don't miss your tax return deadlines, because if you miss the deadlines, you pay fines, and you want to avoid that. There's an annual investment allowance, which is worth thinking about if you're a landlord or you run your own business. And always, 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 if you're self-employed, make sure you claim for all your tax-deductible expenses. If you're self-employed, any expense that is incurred wholly and exclusively for the purposes of the business is allowed for tax. Don't forget to claim your own tax car travel expenses, travel costs. Don't forget to carry forward your previous losses. The rent-a-room scheme that we've talked about. There's an landlord's energy savings scheme that's worth looking at. You can get a special tax allowance of up to £1,500 for insulation and draft proofing. Don't forget to bill all your expenses if you're a landlord. Don't forget to claim the tax relief on your mortgage on your buy-to-let property. Landlords are normally liable for CGT when they sell a rental property. If it's been your main home for some time in the past, you can claim tax relief for the last 18 months of ownership. Pay less tax on savings and investments. Use your ISA allowance. No CGT on shares held in an ISA. Use your junior ISA allowance. Transfer assets to a non-saving spouse. For old